You know what? It's easy to look at the highest of the high top people in the world and go, I want to be like that. But when you witness and see someone who just to be able to do normal things day to day and the struggle that they have to go through just to be able to put that up is much more inspiring than something that someone else doing something exceptional, because they're doing something exceptional for them.
Hello friends, and welcome to the Judo Edit podcast. I'm so excited that you've tuned in today because we are chatting with four-time Olympian and UFC fighter Daniel Kelly. I also have some exciting news of my own. I started the Judo Edit podcast in 2017 because I thought there was an amazing opportunity to share the stories of judoka around the world. I've had 18 conversations and there are over 7,000 listens of these conversations. What that has shown me is that the value of a single conversation can be multiplied infinitely by sharing it with the world. And personally, starting a podcast has allowed me to talk to people I would otherwise have no business talking to. Sabrina Fields-Moser, James Austin, Travis Stevens. What a great excuse to randomly message them and ask for a chat. So, what I want to do is open up the opportunity and experience for you. I'm launching a company which is going to look after the end-to-end management and post-production of podcasts. What that means is that for anybody who's ever wanted to start a podcast but doesn't know how or doesn't have the time to do all the post-production and juggle which software that they should be using, my company TJE Productions will look after all of that for you. All you'll have to do is record the audio, send it to me, and I'll look after the rest. That is everything from initially setting it up, getting it on Apple and Spotify, making sure that the interviews or the talks get edited, and even managing the podcast Instagram page. Your first step is to go to my website, www.tjeproductions.com, and submit your podcast idea. Obviously, TJE stands for The Judo Edit. And so if you join up within the month of February and list that you heard about this opportunity through the Judo Edit podcast, I'll give you your first 2 months half price as a foundation member. Wherever you are in the world, as long as you're speaking English, submit your idea and let's get you on Spotify. Daniel Kelly is known within judo circles as one of the most accomplished athletes in the Australian side of judo. Dan has been to four Olympics, beginning in Sydney 2000 until London 2012. He's known for his hard work, tenacity, and grit. His highest Olympic result was seventh in the Athens 2004 Olympics at 90 kilograms. In between all this, Dan also represented Australia in wrestling at the Commonwealth Games in 2002. And because being a two-sport athlete isn't enough, when Daniel retired from his competitive judo days, he transitioned into mixed martial arts, becoming one of the most prominent judo-based fighters in the UFC. Notable results in the middleweight division include wins over Chris Camozzi and Rashad Evans. At the moment, Dan is the coach of the Australian national judo team, and it is with this background that I'm speaking to him now, as he is finishing up his quarantine period after coaching the Australian team at the Doha Judo Masters. Hey there, Daniel. How are you today?
Good, thank you. Thanks, Mel. Thanks for the nice introduction.
Oh, no worries. You've earned all of it. You know, it's quite strange. For somebody with such a big name in judo in Australia, there are very few videos of you doing judo in your competitive days on the internet. So if you look at your judo during your peak years representing Australia, how would you describe your style of fighting?
As you said, I'd probably never be considered the most naturally technically gifted guy. I was very, very strategic, very fit. And obviously judo's changed a little bit rule set wise. Gripping was a big part of that. And that's probably what held me up internationally, was my capacity to be able to outgrip or match that level with the international guys. But yeah, it's I wasn't a flashy technical athlete, I don't think. Obviously technically sound enough to compete at a high level, but yeah, it's more hard work and grit, like you said at the start as well. That's probably more so. I mean, my favorite throw was Uchimata, but during the period of, say, 2001 or 1999 through till 2008, when leg grabs were so prominent and ride and rolls, it kind of killed Uchimata a little bit for international judo. It's back a lot now. But yeah, at that time, it was really difficult. And unless you had a perfect grip on a high-level guy, if turning in was, you're almost always going to get countered, or it was difficult if you just missed slightly. So yeah, judo's changed a lot in the little bit of time that I've been retired.
And so alongside thinking about those gripping strategies and planning out your fights, how did you develop that mind and that skill to be able to pick up grips, to be able to learn how to, I guess, adapt grips according to an opponent? Was that instinctive, or did you have to really hone that skill?
I honed that skill a lot over years of international training. The biggest thing was I've never been physically the strongest person in a weight division, so I wasn't going to be able to out-muscle or manhandle anyone. So I had to really develop that. So my hands were fast, knew exactly what I wanted to do, and also adjust on the fly. But that's relevant for all combat sports, having the capacity to adjust what you're trying to do within a match or a fight or anything like that. So those skills are very relevant for all athletes at all levels. So that's just something you learn along the way.
Yeah, 100%. What would you consider your biggest strength as a judoka?
Well, that's a big call. I'm not probably that capacity, probably to, at a higher level, be able to work out a good strategy or a good option to go with against someone overseas. And also, it was a lot more difficult. God, I feel like an old man, but we didn't have that much video analysis. It's a lot easier now. I just jump on judo base for the guys when we're overseas and go, okay, this is happening, that's happening. I know what you can do. I know what they're most likely going to do. This is the structure or the set of tactics we're going to go to in this match. Back then, we used to, after a competition, I used to sit down with a notebook and write brief notes on every person in the division, or you used to have to go and ask one of your teammates to just go, oh, just go and have a look over there where such and such is warming up. I've got to fight them. Just see if they're left or right. Like it was a lot different back then. But you also had to, your A game had to be good enough to be able to match an opponent's A game if you didn't know much about them.
Hmm.
Whereas now it's different. They're always training overseas. Like Aoife, for example, has competed against most of the ones in the top 20, trained with most of the ones in the top 30 or 40. Same as Tinker, Josh, Nathan. So they've got a good knowledge of everyone in the division. It wasn't always like that for us.
Yeah, exactly. And when you sort of look at fighting overseas and you talk about, I guess, not having that video access, how did your gripping change when you're fighting, say, a Japanese person who's very technically sound as opposed to like maybe a more rougher European wrestling style?
It's the structures, they just varied slightly as a rule. So the way I do things is I've got a set of rules, right versus left, European style against, as opposed to a more stand-up style. And we used to split it into the Western Europeans, South Americans, Japanese, Korean kind of style, and then the Eastern European style that would always come around the side. And the difficulty was being able to identify when there was a danger very early, because in judo you get thrown, it's all over. So I used to have a set of rules that we'd follow, but also it was always positive. Get your grip and go first. You have to be first rather than waiting to see what they do, because it could be over by that time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so I understand that you were coached for a little while and maybe fought alongside Peter Herman. Is that right?
Peter Herman coached me. I'm not that old. Peter Herman's probably the biggest. Peter's over 80 now. Peter's was a massive influence on my career. He was a national coach a lot of the times, and he's a lot of the stuff I did in the structure and the base of how I approach things now, a lot of that came from him. So he was a very hard man, very, very hard man, very unforgiving. But yeah, I have him to thank for a lot of what I did in the sport.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I think that shift from, I guess, having Australia being so far removed from the rest of the judo world and then having Peter Herman come over to Australia and what that did to the level of judo, what lessons, I guess, did you learn from Peter that were different to what was already being done?
Well, I mean, I was lucky. So he was already well established here. Now, he came from France. He was the coach, the first ever French world champion. He was the first coach at INSEP, their national center. So he was already well established here by the time I got into the senior ranks. And he was starting to national coach at that time as we're leading into Sydney. So I got to deal with his way of doing things from 18, 19 years old. And it was very much what I do now, hard work. He was very uncompromising, but he didn't always accept that, oh, you're just from Australia, that's it. He is like, no, you can push. And he didn't think that of everyone, I don't think, but that structure and the physicality, he had an idea in his head based on what he'd learned and what he'd dealt with in France as to what the platform and level had to be competitive internationally from here. Mm. So that was the thing. And he took us to Japan a lot. He took us to Korea heaps. You know, the first time we went to Korea was 1997. And that was a time later that year where the Korean men had 3 world champions in Paris. Mm. We were going there at the height of their powers, if you like. So we spent a lot of time in Korea, and that taught me a lot too. Some pleasant memories, some not so pleasant memories. I mean, it's the same thing I say now all the time. Consistency, hard work, and structure. If you can tick those boxes, then you have a chance of being able to do something. And he was no different. He was no different at all. And I learned a lot of that from him.
Was there anything from you, like you mentioned that Korea, and it sounded like it had a big impact on you. Are there any techniques from the training there that you apply now to your athletes?
A lot of gripping stuff. I mean, the Koreans always right against right. The left hand onto the lapel will lead first, then the top hand on, then come onto the sleeve. Obviously, the aim is to get your sleeve first, but just the movement stuff as well, because the Koreans are a blend of the Japanese and the European style. So they move very well like the Japanese, but they're also got the physical side of the Koreans as well. So from an actual technique perspective, you always work on your base stuff, but then it evolves over time depending on the international environment as well. So at those international training camps and things like that, it was more trying to impose what you were trying to do rather than like develop a technique. Like it's your techniques have to be able to stand up to that kind of intensity and also scrutiny as well at a higher level. So, yeah, by the time I was going away, I started traveling internationally when I was about 18. Like you develop things at home or things you want to work on, but that was very personalized. It wasn't like the step base of structures around gripping about how you do things is one thing. The individualized techniques all come from the athlete, and then we work on them from there. Because what I've always found in coaching as well is that if an athlete wants to do something themselves, it's going to be much faster and quickly absorbed than if you're imposing it on them. Going, okay, you need to learn this, but I've been working on this. Okay, how are we going to make that work with how you do things now, and how is it going to stand up to being in competition? And if they've got ownership of that, it's always a lot faster than if you go, you're doing this now. Odds and ends you can, but on the whole, the game and the athlete they want to be as a whole actually comes from them a lot more than it comes from the coach. Your coach just puts it all together for them and helps them have a bulletproof structure, if you like.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so if we look at going into the Sydney 2000 Olympics, it's your first games and it's in front of a home crowd, and you begin your Olympic record with a win against Jason Morris. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I'd fought Jason for bronze earlier that year at the British Open and lost a close match. I think back, this is when it was Yukos and Co, because I think it was we both had a Yuko and he had a Coker, I think, and so he just beat me. So it was a nervous match because he's a world and Olympic medalist, a nervous match, but it wasn't an unknown kind of thing. Yeah, I was very nervous before Sydney, very, very nervous.
Yeah, and look, I'm sure you would be. What do you recall of that day in general?
Oh, it was a roller coaster. So I remember coming, and this is what, over 20 years ago now. I remember going to the venue in the morning and looking at the mat and being close to tears through nerves, to be honest, even though you know what you're going to encounter. I always suffer with a lot of anxiety when I compete through my whole career. I mean, it's the fact that you go, oh, you need to deal with your nerves or anything like that. The anxiety never goes away. You just learn to manage it and you learn to deal with the anxiety. That's a big thing too. Everyone's going to be nervous and anxious, not being able to accept it and still be able to compete to your optimal is what the thing is. The anxiety never goes away. I don't believe it goes away. But then I had 4 matches that day. And had 2 good wins, 2 losses. In both the matches I lost, I was actually winning at some point in the match. And yeah, I was half heartbroken at the end of the last match because I came from well down to get in front, and then with 20 seconds to go, I lost the match again, which was upsetting. The guy I lost to was an Irani, and he'd won Asian championships that year, and that day had already beaten the reigning world champion as well. And he threw me for Wazari. He got a Shido. I threw him for Wazari, which I still think was Ippon. And then he threw me again very close to the end. But it was a big day. I mean, I fought Morris. Then I fought Delgado, the Portuguese. And he ended up with bronze that day. Then I beat the Italian. And then I lost to the Iranian. The whole experience was fantastic. Being able to walk out in front of your home crowd for the opening ceremony was really special. And yeah, I mean, clearly I remember it because I can still go through things 20 years later, but it was a great day. It was great. It was great also, even though I didn't get to watch the medal matches because I was competing the next day, it was great that Maria Peckley won a bronze for the country that day. Rebecca Sullivan fought well and beat a high-class opponent as well that in the 52s. So yeah, so it was a big event.
Yeah, and it sounds like, I guess, for a first Olympics, like an amazing experience, especially for the Australian team.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for Olympic cycles, that's at least 16 years of conditioning yourself to compete at the top level. How did you sustain like that level of performance for that long and even continue afterwards?
So 2004, I probably should have changed weight division early. I changed weight very late in the cycle. I was coming down from 90 kilos to make 81s, which got a little bit too much. Then I went up to 90s within the last year and a bit to go up, which was better. After Athens, we had the birth of our first child. I had a shoulder reconstruction and a knee reconstruction within 2 years, 2005, 2006, then went back to the sport. And then I actually retired after 2008 for a couple of years and then came back. So I went in and out of high shape. I don't think I was competitive internationally by the time 2012 came around, but because I had a lot of guys who I was coaching and I still wanted to compete, I navigated through the world ranking system to qualify. It was also good to be able to say, well, I didn't just qualify for the ones that you qualified through Oceania. I competed and qualified under the world ranking list system as well. I think we had a team of 6 for 60, 66, 90 unders. We had a team of 5, and then there was an injury. So Jake Angiwatha got in because someone had to pull out for injury very early, a car accident, a guy, and broke his leg and couldn't compete. So it was a team of 5, then became a team of 6. It was a lot different from having a team of 14 for the 3 games before that. So that was one of the reasons why I did it as well, just to prove that I could. Even 100 kilos, the guys were a lot bigger and stronger than I was, like the top guys. At least at 90s and 81s, I was actually competitive at a higher level as well.
Yeah.
I think I picked my marks. That's what it was. I picked the competitions I needed to be ready for, I needed to be good for. And yeah, there's a lot of pressure associated with those, but to be honest, competing in sports, pressure. So it's just being able to manage the anxiety I spoke about just before. And yeah, I picked where I needed to be good.
Across those Olympics, what is your favorite memory from any of the Olympics that you've been to? As an athlete, I mean.
As an athlete, my result in Athens was really, really good. I beat a really good guy there as well, who was well an Olympic medalist. Obviously, Sydney, everything around Sydney was fantastic. I've got memories from each one kind of, meaning we were lucky. Our son got to spend a bit of time and come to the village for 2012. So that's really special as well. Beijing was really good. Maria fought for a medal there. I didn't do as well as I wanted to. I lost in overtime to the Japanese. But we had a lot of private struggles with Eric's health to actually just get there. So that was special as well. So lots of different things. Each Olympics is special. It only happens once every 4 years.
You know, you mentioned that it's once every 4 years. And I guess technically you've been to 5 Olympics because you were the coach in Rio for the Australian judo team. How different was it for you going as a coach as opposed to an athlete? Did you feel more pressure or was it less pressure? Or I don't know, how was it different?
It's more pressure because I haven't got control over what the athletes do. We had a young team in 2016. They were all pretty young. I think the oldest person in the team was under 25. Mm. So about 24. So we had quite a young team. It was more of an educational thing for a lot of them as well in terms of the experience. They also did very well because they had to qualify through the world ranking system as well. It's more pressure because I haven't got control over the outcomes. When I'm competing, I've got control over what happens with me. With them, it's them doing it. So it's coaching's very stressful. I think I've aged a lot in the last 3 or 4 years. That's probably due to a lot of the coaching stuff I do now. The logistics around it was fine. Also keeping a lid on their excitement because it can be overwhelming sometimes going to an Olympic Games, going into the village and just all the circus around it. So just keeping a lid on that, making sure they understand what they're there for, which they did. But yeah, much different. It's more work than enjoyment for coaching, for sure.
And so that's interesting that you bring up the excitement part of it and how that interrelates with the athletes, because it seems through, you know, the media that a lot of being at the Olympics is the Olympic experience and the food hall and meeting everyone else on like the team and all these world-class athletes. So what is it like trying to operate at a high level and stay focused as a competitor within that environment?
I never cared about the whole experience. I was there to compete and do as well as I can. Everything else was a bonus. Like a lot of things in judo, I wanted to do as well as I could. I didn't really, like a lot of the stuff around it was just a bonus. Mm. So as soon as we got into Sydney, into the village, I actually went home for a few days because I didn't need to be in that circus and get all, you know, dragged into it all. And that's just what I said with the athletes. And they managed that really well. You know, you remember why you're here. You work so hard. Enjoy these things, but don't let it overtake you. You've got to remember that you're here for an actual particular reason that you've worked for 4 years. And that's, it is an experience and you need to be grateful to enjoy it, but you can't have it overwhelming.
Exactly. And even back in your days preparing for the Olympics, when you felt, I guess, either discouraged or overwhelmed or intimidated, or even a bit of that anxiety that you mentioned before, if you were intimidated by the size of your goals, did you have any strategies that you put in place or what did you do?
So that's actually a really good question. And that comes back to really standard goal setting within a session, within a short period, within a 2 year period. It all the small goals you have, they build up to your big goal. So I knew where I wanted to go. Then I went, how do I get there? And I always plotted back a path to how I got there. Now, obviously, nothing ever goes exactly to plan, but if you stay on pretty much the track that you need to stay on, and obviously there's high pressure moments within that, but if you break everything down into smaller goals and smaller plans, the bigger achievement is a little bit less daunting. Mm. I mean, you get discouraged all the time, especially as I got older competing and fighting. It's really hard because you're battling against your body as well, not really wanting to do the work that was necessary. Probably lucky that I'm lucky I'm pretty stubborn, so I could drag myself through a lot of that. But you know, athletes need to know when they should rest, but they also need to know when they've got to train through being fatigued and tired as well. So it's a really fine balance.
Mm. And did you have any, I guess, self-talk, anything that you used to say to yourself to get yourself fired up on those days when you needed to train but you were fatigued?
Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of little cliches we use that I used for the guys now. It's things like the session you miss, you never get back. There's no making up sessions, you know, unless it's locked in that that's a time to rest, you do your sessions and you just, you remember the goal. And I always, especially conditioning stuff, which I didn't enjoy that much, you always think that you're doing this, your opposition aren't. So you're at home working, they're not doing it. You're working just to try and stay ahead of the game all the time. So that was always an internal driver as well.
I find that really interesting because you've also mentioned in a couple of other interviews that you've done that you were self-coached since 2003.
Yep.
How did you plan your own training cycles when you were an athlete? Did you sort of have specific areas of focus or periodization? What did that process look like for you?
That's exactly what I did. Set a structure out. What we used to do, I'd write out a 6-week block and I normally do things in 5 to 6 week blocks in terms of technical development or something we need to work on. And then the group that I'd be training with, I go, okay, this is what we're going to do. I give, ask for feedback from them a little bit, not much. It's not a complete democracy. And then we just do that. It was hard. It's not for everyone, coaching and training at the same time. And I probably a little bit to my detriment at times as well, but it's also a capacity to bring a group along on your vision and journey as well. And so me being in the trenches, doing it with them, probably helped them a little bit too. And they go, okay, he's doing exactly the same thing that I am and he's getting there, then it's a possibility that I can get there too.
And in terms of maybe like the split between actual time doing technical judo and randori, what was that balance like?
Good question. It varies. As now that I coach more, it varies more than it used to. But I mean, I always do an element of randori every session, whether it be a mix of niwaza and tachiwaza or just tachiwaza, all depends. And then depending on where we are in terms of the importance of a competition will dictate the load and the break. So in a closer to a competition, they get shorter with longer breaks. Out further, it's the longer, harder ones, unless we want to mix it up a little bit, because judo can become a little bit monotonous too at times. It has to be varied to keep everyone stimulated, and closer to an important competition, you need to change your load. But because there's so many competitions in judo, you can't be peaking for an event every second week. Sometimes there's events that you just train through. So, okay, you got a competition on the weekend. That's your training set. That's one of the training sessions, or we just train through. That's just an extra thing you do. So a lot of people go, oh, we've got a comp, we need to ease up. Yeah, well, that's not a comp we're peaking for. So you just work through and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And when you look at Australian judo at the moment, are there any areas of Australian judo which could be increased?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a good question. So daily training environment is always an issue in Australia, getting the people together. That's why the girls have got a little bit of inroad in, because they've got the small boys they can train with for that extra physicality. The boys, it's a little bit more difficult because unless they've got a strong group together to train with, they have to go external. The girls have to go external too because the reactions are different. But if anything was shown with Aoife's result a couple of weeks ago, it showed that if we've got a good group around her, boys included, for her to train with, it's possible to get high-level results just from a home structure. So, and that really highlighted that. Yeah, daily training environment, consistency. Now, the hub system that started in Australia where everyone comes together once a week is fantastic because you all need to help each other. Judo is an individual sport, but you need a big group to train together. So having that is going to be good. When competitions start again, have to go overseas. I mean, Maria calculated, and I agree, for the cadets, they need to be going twice to Europe a year, once to Japan. The juniors, a 3-in-1 kind of thing. And then the seniors, they're away for up to 3 or 4 months of the year just to try and keep up with the rest of the world. There's always areas to work on. There's areas for us to work on too, or for me to work on. And daily training environment and consistency is a key one. You don't get better in the lead up to a competition. You get better before that, around that. That's where you do your getting improved strength, getting improved fitness, improving some technical stuff. Because when it's time to get ready for a competition, you're getting ready for the competition. You're not improving.
Maybe on the flip side, are there any areas of Australian judo which you're very proud of at the moment?
Oh, absolutely. How our guys are going internationally, like they're getting more and more competitive overseas, our junior and cadet program, the whole level's coming up, which is fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. So looking more a little bit about your judo and your transition into MMA after 2012, was that always part of the plan to take the skills that you'd sort of fostered and built up in judo and apply them to, I guess, an arena that was a little bit more commercial, a little bit more mainstream?
No. I was always a fan of MMA and I loved it. I actually had a fight in 2006 and went back to judo. After I retired in 2008, in those couple of years, I had some kickboxing fights just because I like competition and maybe a little bit crazy, but did that. And then after 2012, the opportunity, I wanted to see how I go. I never, ever foresaw me going to the level I went to. I mean, I was 35 when I started the sport properly and actually invested any kind of time into it. So it was, I went, oh, I'll have a few fights and see how it goes and see how I enjoy it. I never realized I'd go to the level that I ended up going to.
That just goes to show how much your hard work and your that mentality of, you know, grit and stubbornness is able to take you. That's really incredible.
Thanks. You know, it was an interesting journey, that bit.
You know, in judo, as you, I guess, of course you know this, but the right hander like stands with their right foot forwards. But I've noticed that you sort of maintained that right-handed judo stance in MMA, and that's sort of become a southpaw stance. Was it ever a consideration for you to switch your stance in kickboxing in order to maximize the striking?
I'm actually left-handed.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but that's a really good point. So,
did you fight right-handed in judo?
Yes, but my sleeve hand was a strong hand. So, and I've got lots of theories on that as well. But any of the judo people who I deal with, or most of them, stay southpaw, because that's the stance they've been most comfortable in, and their lead hand ends up being their hook, or their hook mostly becomes their strongest punch. I mean, Hector Lombard, who was a judo guy, he's a southpaw, but he's right-handed. So I think it was more comfortable. A lot of wrestlers will start orthodox, but actually when they shoot, they switch very close, because the standard wrestling stance is actually a southpaw stance. But they throw an overhand and step in to switch so that their stance is where it should be for their wrestling structure. But I just left it for the judo guys to say, I feel comfortable here. I said, well, you have to navigate it that way. I was just lucky that I was actually left-handed as well. Left-handed, like writing, that it was very comfortable for me.
Okay, yeah. So that brings up an interesting point, because you're fighting right-handed in judo, but you've got a more dominant left hand. Did you think that was an advantage for you because you had more, you know, pull on the sleeve? Did it change your style? Did you think that it, I guess, gave you a different type of throwing style?
Maybe. My dad, who did judo as well, always said, because you're left-handed, I should end up competing left-handed. But I was always very comfortable standing the way I was. I led against right-handers. This hand is the one that structurally should lead anyway. So I never really thought about it until I started doing some striking and went, okay, this is going to be an easier transition, like from a power perspective, because I'm in the correct stance for it anyway. But I never really considered or thought about it that much.
Fair enough. And what was the hardest part of going from judo to MMA?
Learning how to strike, because basic structure, basic stance. I was, 35, 36 when I was crossing over. So my body was already pretty beat up. So I had to change a lot of how I stood, how I reacted to things. And that took a long time. But through my whole career, I spent more time striking than I did the other elements of the game, because they were all reasonably in place. And then as I moved into coaching, I spent a lot of time also in the in-between bits, because MMA is its own sport as well. So you need to be able to do a lot of different elements, but it's actually a sport as well. So say grappling on the ground, there is BJJ elements to it, but it's MMA grappling. Like the takedowns, it's not straight wrestling, it's not straight judo, it's MMA grappling. So there are differences to the game as well.
For you, how long does it usually take to ingrain a new skill or strategy into your muscle memory?
very long. But just work. It's just hard work. Like with everything, hard work, consistency, set a structure, set how you want to do things. And yeah, so it's not as, okay, if I do it this many times, I'm going to remember it. It's like, you need to practice it with no resistance. You need to practice it under fatigue. You need to practice it under resistance. And then that's how you build up your capacity to actually use the skill.
So you've mentioned that structure is a very important part of all of this multiple times. So I'm just curious, so how much detail do you plan, I guess, a training day? Is it, do you have like a specific number of reps at whatever intensity and then another number of reps at another intensity? I guess, what does your program for a structure look like?
So that's a good question. I vary some things because the guys in judo are on the mat for a significant amount of time in a week. we have a concept or a theme that we work on. For example, we do an Ashiwaza theme, and we have things linked into that, some personalized, some generalized for everyone. We do a lot of gripping drills, but I do blocks of time because we can't just do one thing one week, another thing another week. If we're doing something or we're working on a concept, it's for 6 or 7 weeks. And the variations around that are rest and recovery and randori, any fitness components we're going to do, depending on what I see overall as something we need to work on. And then I actually do individualized two-on-one sessions with people as well, where we can hone in their own personal technical points and specifics as well. Yeah, I do harp on with structure a bit, but it's just, it's an easier way than going, everything has to be planned. Everything has to be done for a reason. So it's that's the easiest all-encompassing word to use is structure, I suppose. But yeah, so I stick on themes always for 4 to 6 weeks. And then obviously then we'll go into, if we've got a competition phase, say nationals, which everyone does, then we'll work on specific drills under certain sorts of duress, under certain sorts of fatigue, and we build that up into nationals.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And no, I agree that 100% that there is so much value in having a structure and I guess an interweaving reason why everything is being done. Like there's nothing worse than being assigned like an exercise and having no idea what it's for. And then at the end of the day, it doesn't build into anything.
Yeah.
And so I guess looking a little bit more at that crossover between judo and entering the mixed martial arts arena.
Yeah.
With judo being so traditional, was it a surprise for you to enter the hype and publicity that came with the UFC?
Yeah, I hate it. I don't like the circus at all. I mean, I'm on social media. My social media presence isn't huge because I don't enjoy that part of it. I love the competition. I love competing, but the circus around it isn't my favorite thing at all. And we've got a lot of different guys in the gym, some in the UFC, some not. Some have varying degrees of what they do on social media. I've never been a fan. I do understand what it's there for because you need to sell tickets and make money, but it most certainly isn't and wasn't my favorite thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that it just added to the pressure around competing?
It's a lot of talk.
Right.
I'll give you an example. Before I fought one of my fights, I said one thing in a news article once. I said, I'm going to make the guy's life a living hell. And I got asked and quoted about that in about 8 interviews after one comment. And they're like, so that kind of thing, I'm like, you just end up repeating yourself and saying the same thing over and over again, but you don't want to be too dry either because the fan support is important as well. But it's just different personalities take it different ways and like or hate it differently.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess it's interesting that you've been involved as an athlete within both of those organizations at a high level and being able to see the way that the UFC has exploded in popularity. Do you think that that's, I guess, a viable thing for judo to do? Is there any chance that judo could, I guess, grow and almost become a little bit more mainstream?
Overseas it is. In Europe, judo's massive. In Japan, it's massive. I mean, when Abe and Maruyama had their match, I'm pretty sure the whole of Japan stopped to watch that. And I reckon there would have been millions and millions of people around the world watching. So it's not mainstream in Australia or in America, but in Europe, judo's really big. Really, really big. I wouldn't say it's as mainstream as the UFC or anything is across the whole world, but judo is big. And it's in a good position now. I don't think it needs to be any more mainstream than what it is overseas. Australia, it'd be good to have a higher profile, but there needs to be an element of traditionalist to it as well.
Within Australia, is there anything that we could replicate from the UFC or learn from the UFC in terms of maturing commercially?
It all comes from results. The better the guys do, the more it's going to build up their profile. The Cats boys have got a pretty good profile, but results will build that up further. More clubs, more commercial clubs, that'll help build up the platform as well. So we're gone are the days, and they still exist, and it's great that they still are at the the recreational, pick the mats up, put them down twice a week kind of thing. There's a lot more full-time, actual judo-centered centers around now, and that's going to help build the platform, build the profile as well.
And your own gym is called Resilience Training Center. In your experience, how do you define resilience?
Being able to deal with adversity, being able to be knocked down and get back up and recover. That's what resilience is.
And is there anybody, I guess, who represents resilience to you, whether that be someone in the past or someone in the present?
Oh, there are two. My mother and my son are probably the two best examples of resilience. And look, it took a long time to find the name, and also the symbol is actually an African symbol for resilience as well. So it's all linked in there. So.
If you don't mind me asking, what has your mum gone through and what has your son gone through that inspires you?
My mum had a car accident when she was 16, and she's been in a wheelchair ever since then. She's a paraplegic. She raised the three of us, myself, my brother, my sister, raised us, worked full-time from when I was 12. Her being in a wheelchair was never a barrier or an excuse for anything. She did everything that any normal mum would do. And then obviously Eric's had a lot of health issues and continues to have a lot of health issues, and he still carries on. He starts year 10 on Monday. So it's just, you know what, it's easy to look at the highest of the high top people in the world and go, I want to be like that. But when you witness and see someone who just to be able to do normal things day to day and the struggle that they have to go through just to be able to put that up is much more inspiring than something that someone else doing something exceptional, because they're doing something exceptional for them. So that's much more inspiring for me.
And I can see how that attitude has filtered in through the way that you've pushed yourself and just that resilience that you've shown in your life as well. That's really incredible.
No, thank you.
Throughout your MMA fights, your slogan has been Dad's Army. What does that mean to you?
Well, that's funny. So that's part of the hype and the circus around MMA. It's just, oh, you're an old guy. You know, he's got gray hair. His body's not, doesn't look as chiseled as some of the other guys. All my corners and coaches were dads. And I just started doing a hashtag Dad's Army. And I never realized, again, I didn't realize it'd take off as much as it did, but it took off big time. So we got some T-shirts made, and yeah, now it really is Dad's Army. Even the boys who I coach now still hashtag Dad's Army. So it's good. It's good.
That's funny. That's a cool story as well. And if you look back at, you know, your career, whether it be the judo or the wrestling or the mixed martial arts, what has been the most rewarding part of it for you?
I get asked a lot, what's better, judo, going to the Olympics, or fighting in the UFC? It's still judo every time. If I could, I'm sad I didn't get to fight for an Olympic medal or win an Olympic medal, but yeah, that's always a dream. If I could pick one between one or the other, it's judo wins every time. The MMA was a good short career at the end. It was very lucrative financially, and it helped with my business as well to build that up. But yeah, and I've been doing judo since I was 7 years old, and I'm still in the community, still volunteering, still over here spending 2 weeks in quarantine for the athletes as well. So yeah, judo is going to always be the number one in my heart for sure when it comes to sport.
Yeah. And you know, you are on the Judo Edit podcast, so that is the correct answer.
Exactly.
And if our listeners want to follow you online, where's the best place for them to find you?
Gee, Instagram is Daniel Kelly Judo Resilience Training Center, and I'll make sure that we get you some more followers too.
That would be awesome.
Guys as well. So.
Thank you.
But yeah, no problems at all. Yeah, Daniel Kelly Judo on Instagram. That's the easiest one. Or Dan Kelly Judo Twitter, I think, but I don't jump on Twitter very often.
And I understand that you are almost out of quarantine. So once you get back to Melbourne, where's the first place you're going to go?
Judo training. We've got judo training at 10:30. So Tinker, Aoife and Harry will all catch an Uber to Resilience. They'll train and then they'll go home.
Thank you for your time today, Dan. Thank you for sharing your stories. It's been very interesting to get a view of that from your perspective. Thank you for sharing your time.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Hey friends, thanks for listening to that episode with Dan Kelly. I know I learned a lot from him and it was a blast getting to talk with him. If like me, you have gotten the value and can see the opportunities that podcasting can bring, and if you see that there's an opportunity for a great podcast idea, then go to www.tjeproductions.com. Podcasting has absolutely exploded in the last year, and this is your chance to be featured on Spotify, Apple, and Google. If you're an individual, influencer, or business, there is so much opportunity for you to use the podcasting platform for your own ideas or as your own marketing channel. Wherever you are in the world, go to www.tjeproductions.com right now and let's get you on Spotify. As usual, like, follow, share with your friends, and this is Melissa Budiato signing off.